This is an ABC podcast.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt and Jonathan Kendall on ABC Radio.
It's very difficult to explain the nature of depression. It defies logic. What it does do, though, is it sucks the joy of life out of an individual. You see everything in a negative fashion. There are hundreds of thousands of Australians who today could be taking advantage of the use of these drugs to help therapies.
That's former Liberal Trade Minister Andrew Robb talking on 7:30 about how he thinks psychedelic drugs could be used to treat mental illness, like the depression that he lives with.
Psychedelics defined the countercultural hippie movement of the 60s and the 70s, Jono. And if you think about the so-called trippy drugs, you know, LSD, magic mushrooms, think Timothy Leary or Andy Warhol.
But their role as a form of medicine to treat mental illness has been debated for a while. In March, the Australian federal government announced it would provide $15 million for clinical trials to determine if psilocybin and MDMA could help treat mental illness and post-traumatic stress disorder.
And then we saw just last week a new privately funded research centre was launched here in Melbourne to help develop these psychedelic treatments.
Globally, this type of treatment is big business. Universities and even Wall Street have said that they want in. It's being called the psychedelic renaissance.
It's going to be an interesting conversation today. We're asking, do psychedelic drugs play a role in the treatment of mental illness and PTSD? Or does the stigma, the stereotype of the trippy hippie Woodstock drugs stop us from moving forward with these types of treatments?
On ABC Radio, this is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt and Jonathan Kendall.
The Psyche Institute is funded by a North American biotechnology company, and Jerome Sarris is a collaboration between researchers from leading world universities. Jerome Sarris is the co-director of the Psyche Institute. Good morning.
Great to be with you.
Can you tell us what your institute does?
Yes, we're a not-for-profit, and yes, absolutely, we do have some commercial investment, but also as things develop, we'll get some philanthropic investment as well as, you know, looking for government support as well. But our main goal is really to advance research in the field of medicinal psychedelics. So it's something which, yeah, we're very passionate about, and which, as you said before, the world is moving strongly towards.
When we talk about clinical trials that you'll be running, what will they look like? What will they encompass?
Well, there's a range of phases of research, for example, preclinical work to develop particular novel formulations of these medicinal psychedelics, but also phase one work. So if you're looking at using some of these formulations or novel chemical entities based on these compounds in humans, you've got to do early phase one work, as well as the phase two and phase three work for specific psychiatric disorders.
And what are your interim results? What kind of results have you had so far?
We've had recently some really quite compelling epidemiological evidence, which has shown that one of the interventions, ayahuasca, which is a South American psychedelic plant-based medicine, that actually has shown that it's had really remarkable effects in reducing people's depression who have used it, as well as reducing traumatic or sense of traumas, and also reducing their substance and alcohol use as well.
So we're talking about a couple of different drugs here, but I just want to drill down into that one for a second. So this is, the active ingredient is DMT in South American ayahuasca. So what is that? What do you know about that as a drug?
Well, DMT, look, it is a hallucinogenic compound. It may create in some people euphoria, perceptual changes, has a range of effects also on various neurochemical pathways. And people experience it. It can actually have a very potent short-acting effect when people take DMT, but it's used in ayahuasca in a combination, what's called a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, which is from a plant called ayahuasca, this particular plant, and it's used in combination with that, which means that the DMT remains longer in the person's system. So instead of getting sort of a quick sort of 15-minute experience, it can last hours. So people will go through this therapeutic journey through hours and undergo that experience.
That sounds pretty intense and very experimental. You know, when we talk about microdosing or using small amounts of, say, magic mushrooms or LSD as a way to help treat mental illness. But then when you're talking about someone basically going on a trip for a couple of hours, that seems pretty out there.
Look, certainly in the traditional sense of, you know, how we consider the concept of a trip. I mean, obviously, you know, through the lens of the 60s. But it's really important to frame this in a modern context. We're talking the work we're doing and what we're obviously researching and the context which we're coming from is that this is to be used within a therapeutic model. So there's medical oversight, there's, you know, clinical psychologists involved, in some cases nurses, and the person is taken through this experience with psychological preparation in a very safe setting, and that they undergo this particular experience, having also integration involved. So they may have, say, a couple of sessions of psychological preparation and also thorough screening to make sure it's appropriate for them. They then undergo the actual experience, which, yes, may last hours. And then they'll have other follow-up sessions to integrate, you know, what can be incredibly profound experiences for the person's life. And then may, depending on the therapy, undergo an additional one or two experiences with the medicinal psychedelic and more integration work.
When you talk about they go through a really strong screening process on this, what's the screening process look like? What sort of alarm bells would go off? What sort of questions are you asking?
Sure. Well, I mean, this is the thing. So some of the psychedelic experiences which happen, people may travel overseas for treatment, for example, if, say, it's in the context of, say, the South American ayahuasca journeys with shamans and so forth. Then you've got people experimenting, for example, on your typical sort of magic mushroom type trip. But what we're talking about is framing this, as I said before, within a particular therapeutic, safe construct. And by that, part of that is also screening. So the clinical psychologist or the psychiatrist have to screen to see, is this person the right candidate? So, for example, it's contraindicated in people with bipolar disorder, if they're obviously having a bipolar 1 manic episode, also people with psychotic disorders such as schizophrenia. So those people would be excluded from that. So thereby, yes, we do need proper screening.
We're actually talking about, I guess, the role of psychedelic drugs today and how they can be used when it comes to helping treat people maybe with PTSD or mental illness. Jerome Sarris is with you. He is a researcher and academic. He's in a doctorate at the University of Queensland in the Department of Psychiatry, but is also the co-director of the Psyche Institute, which is about to start clinical trials when it looking into how psychedelic drugs can help with mental illness.
And is there a chance, Jerome, that people could have negative experiences like Wendy was talking about there? I think it's been called a bad trip. Is that possible?
Oh, look, absolutely. And look, I think we approach it through a very sober lens, that for some people they can have negative reactions, depending on the compound, depending on the person. We can actually also have certain screening tools to work out as best as we can what characteristics may end up influencing a person to have better experiences or worse experiences. We know also it's important the set and the setting. So what is the person's mindset? And that's why adequate psychological preparation and care is needed. What's the setting like? So, you know, when people are undergoing these particular therapies, they're in a very comfortable room, couch, nice music playing, usually an eye mask on. So the setting is also very important. But look, bad experiences can happen, and that's why it really needs to be within that psychological medical framework to support people.
The ayahuasca experience that you're talking about, is that it's sort of, you know, the level 10, if we're talking from 1 to 10 when it comes to I guess, experimental type treatment. I mean, the other areas of LSD and MDMA, which people may know as ecstasy, are also drugs that you look at using. And I guess that's a form of microdosing, isn't it, when it comes to treating mental illness or PTSD. There's various trauma-based illnesses that, you work with. Are they a little more, a little less hardcore?
Yeah, look, I would say certainly the people's general understanding and experience is that DMT, you know, can really elicit quite a strong psychedelic experience, whereas psilocybin, I think, tends to have a for want of a better word, a fluffier experience. But that's not the same for everybody. LSD tends to last longer because it's got a longer half-life, so people may have a longer experience. But then, you know, the feedback we do get also is that sometimes when, you know, a lot of doctors do this work with people, in particular we're talking over in the US, that when they do actually have, or people actually have the longer experience, it may be a bit rough at first. So they go through, you know, it is obviously a very strong psychological experience. So it's about adapting through that. But once they push through that, there tends to be a lot of the time very profound experiences occur. Let's just say they're working through trauma or depression or alcohol and substance misuse, that they are, you know, really confronting those particular issues and processing those traumas. Mm. So it can be confronting, but then at the other side, there can also be quite profound healing.
Alex is in Carlton. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning.
What are you thinking?
Look, I'm retired from the health field, mental health field. Just a question, are there any studies at the moment or trials using ayahuasca or any of the hallucinogens for people that are in life stage and are suffering extreme anxiety and trauma?
It's a really good question, Alex. There actually has been some research and work, Jerome, done into end-of-life care and the role that psychedelics could play.
Yeah, absolutely. And Dr. Marg Ross over at St. Vincent's, I put in a plug for her. She's a, just an absolutely wonderful human being, great researcher and clinician. And she does this particular work in terms of end-of-life anxiety. And that's exactly, I think, one of the key issues is that we tend to frame things medically, well, certainly in psychiatry, around specific diagnosed disorders. Whereas some people, especially with end-of-life, I suppose you'd say existential issues and challenges, they may not necessarily fit into this nice, neat diagnostic characteristic. But for them, it is quite traumatic. End-of-life issues, death issues, absolutely. So I think psychedelics do have a role in this particular area, and somebody like Marg is one of our collaborators. Is pursuing this, and we wish her all the best with it.
Yeah, well, let's go to Tim in Bridgewater now. Good morning, Tim. What do you want to say?
Okay, everyone there. Just what the doctor's talking about does remind me of some literature I read a couple of decades ago about studies in North America that did, it was around middle America, around Milwaukee there. They had some really exciting results across a range of issues to do with mental illness, but also people who are suffering from procrastination, like architects, seem to get a lot of help out of it. But one of the things that stuck with me, I wonder if it's still got applications, mind you, that disease was suppressed, a lot of these ideas because of the times, anti-drug sentiment, was the treatment of alcoholism. Although across small samples, what I remember is that some of them, it's one of the most difficult illnesses to treat. But from small samples, they were getting the highest results for successful treatment of alcoholism than any other process they'd use, whether it be counselling or drugs. It may have something like 30%. It would have been pursued, and there was a lot of excitement from the doctors involved. But just at the time, what you're saying now seems like, are they digging back over these studies?
Tim, that's a really good point, because I was reading that there were some similar statements, Jerome, that was looking at some of the successes that we've seen globally for people maybe that are living through some form of drug or alcohol issues that they may have. And a part of this kind of seems like, well, the last thing you want to do is then give people a psychedelic drug, but it's been helpful. Is that correct?
Yes, and I can see how that would seem counterintuitive. And some people, I guess, if they don't know the evidence or the mechanisms of action behind it, may think it is quite strange. But look, the data, I can only say, which we've got, is really quite compelling that for people who, for example, do undergo ayahuasca therapies, that they do report the far less desire to use substances or alcohol.
Not everyone is, you know, completely on board with this, though. The College of Psychiatrists is urging caution.
Well, we're not denying the alternatives. We're saying that we need to do the science to get the safety and get the efficacy to make sure that that's right. The history of psychiatry is littered with things that were great white hopes or great promises that have actually turned out to not be so.
That's Associate Professor John Allen, who's the immediate past president of the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists. And so he finished up in May in that role. But he's urging caution on this. Do you think the science is in, Jerome, or does there more work need to happen?
Oh, look, we certainly urge caution as well. We're aligned with the college's position with that. We need more research, and it needs to be conducted in a safe environment. There's no issue about that. I think it's just more so that we're aligned to say, look, let's get out there and do the research now. So we're not saying, yes, tomorrow let's, you know, be setting up LSD clinics on every street corner. That's not what we're saying. It's a case of, you know, we do need to advance the research. The only other point I would say is that for some psychiatrists who do wish to, via the SASCAT-B regulations, prescribe some of these psychedelics, there has been a bit of a challenge recently because it's being approved for specialised cases on the national level by the TGA, but at the state levels are unfortunately or have been dragging their heels a bit in terms of allowing the psychiatrists to prescribe directly to their patients. So
yeah,
we're hoping
I think their
that
interim decision
resolved.
Yeah, was looking yeah. at against rescheduling MDMA and psilocybin from a prohibited substance to a controlled medicine. If someone, Jerome Sarris is with you, the co-director of the Psyche Institute, just opened last Friday here in Melbourne, looking at running clinical trials on psychedelic drugs. Is this something, if you are living with depression or anxiety or PTSD, would something like this help you in conjunction with, and I use inverted commas, you know, traditional medicine? Is it something maybe that you would think is beneficial for someone where nothing else has worked? Or where does it fit into the picture of a patient?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And typically what we do get is a lot of patients, unfortunately, who the Western approach, the traditional, say for example, of depression, antidepressants and psychotherapy just hasn't been working for them, and they're at their wit's end. Some people, for example, with PTSD, I mean, there's discussions certainly whether we can advance, a program of research to do with vets and PTSD was, based on some of the really strong US data to do with MDMA. So there's really encouraging data out there. The question is, it's a case of at what stage do people get that? Now, we're not in any way saying, yes, it's for everybody and nor will it be in the future. But I think what the obvious low-hanging fruit is people with treatment-resistant depression who have tried a range of other treatments, especially, suicidal and there's issues with that. I mean, ketamine therapy also looks like certainly a promising treatment in that regard. But also, there is very, very minor research. It needs to happen more about microdosing. So for people who use a tenth of the normal dose of, say, LSD or psilocybin, that they use that for ongoing depression management. But there isn't enough data to firmly support that at present.
Well, Peter from St Kilda has experience with microdosing. What is that, Peter? Good morning.
Good morning. I have a 27-year-old son who 4 years ago developed a chronic illness called cluster headaches. cluster headaches, to put them into context, if the worst migraine that can be experienced is a 5 out of 10, a cluster headache is an 11 out of 10. They call them the suicide headaches. There's no understanding of the cause of them, and there's no cure for them, and the pain is excruciating. Because of the desperation that this illness provides, my son did an enormous amount of research, and he came to us and said that he'd discovered a lot of articles on microdosing and that he wanted to try it. Now, obviously, every parent goes, oh, my God, you know, my son's going to be tripping and it's going to look like an Austin Powers movie. However, I was there with him when he did it. The microdose is literally a microdose. It is a droplet that is put on the tongue, and there was no tripping. And what it provided was a relief, not a cure, not a solution, but it provided a relief for him, because these things happen, as they described, as clusters. They
so, come Peter, clusters. Is he having to then source that illegally?
Let's just say they're not available legally. And he, part of his research was to ensure that he wasn't being given something. And there is, as I said, if you ask for anybody, the only thing that provides any ease to this thing is direct oxygen, high-grade oxygen. So, he has a tank by his work desk, he has a tank by his bed, and when he gets one of these episodes, the only thing that will help him get through them is putting an oxygen mask on. And so there is a sort of, not an underworld, but there is sort of people that suffer from these. It's very few, and of course, because drug companies won't make a lot of money out of it, there is no research, and I can only ask the authorities, I can only ask the medical profession to say there are some people there that are going through just intolerable things, and just to say that back in the 60s, a lot of people got hooked on LSD is absolutely no reason to hold up research, because there are some very...
You're right, Peter. It's that stigma of the 60s. Isn't it, that we hold on to? And John, we were having this conversation off air about whether or not that same stigma was what held back research and trials when it comes to cannabis.
Yep. Yeah, and things have changed with that. I think that's kind of moved from the fringes into kind of mainstream medical science now. But Jerome Sarris, when you were listening to Peter there speak about his son experimenting with microdoses, what were you thinking? Because we don't want to encourage people to use drugs that could, you know, end up harming them.
Oh, that's right. Look, firstly, I have a strong sense of compassion. Just to hear a story like that, I'm glad that his son has experienced some relief. This story is not uncommon, and in fact, four cluster headaches, microdosing or even full dosing of psilocybin has been used, and there's a number of clinical trials going on globally looking at this. We hear really quite stunning results in terms of that. Now, of course, I'm not advocating for people to go out and do that, but it just raises the question, if people are desperate, I mean, if you're in that amount of pain and suffering, you'd do anything to relieve it. So
what's happening in the brain? Like, what was happening in Peter's son's brain when he was taking those drugs? We know they cause extra activity in the brain, but what exactly is
happening? How did it help?
Yeah, my understanding is it's because of the serotonergic modulatory effects classic psychedelics such as psilocybin. So because of the cluster headaches, it's to do with, from what I understand anyway, that vasoconstriction and vasorelaxation, that it's primed by the serotonergic system, so it modulates by that pathway.
Well, Tim's been listening and heard that Dad rang in and has called us. So, Tim, welcome. We're talking about you now. We can talk with you. This is something that you did a lot of research on, and again, as Jono said, we by no means promote that people should try and source anything like this illegally. But how did it help you?
Yeah, and nor do I. I purely just want to advise people that research should be done. So large heroic doses of psilocybin mushrooms have cured clusters for me, where I've been experiencing 10 to 15 headaches a day, as Dad said, 11 out of 10, and they've reduced it to one a fortnight in one dose. So there's obviously physical benefits, and my understanding is that there's large anti-inflammatory properties for these medicines. And then to what Dad talked about with microdosing, this condition has given me great anxiety, and microdosing provided significant relief for me, and really kind of cured my anxiety within the space of 2 months, and really equipped me with the tools to manage that myself.
And Tim, how often do you have to take this treatment?
For the psilocybin mushrooms, I kind of dose as I need, but it can be quarterly, it can be bi-yearly, but I have, every time I've done it, it's had a significant improvement for my chronic cluster headaches, to which they are, to a certain extent, treatment resistant, and this has provided me immense relief.
That's great. And
how have you dealt with the stigma around that? We've been talking about, you know, this stigma and this stereotype of a, you know, of a drug user. How have you dealt with that?
It was something that I first had to overcome with my parents. Obviously, I want to be open about my treatment, but there's some great media out there at the moment, How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan, which really kind of looks at psychedelics from a level view, and comes at it with no bias, and really just explains it from a completely objective standpoint. And there's short podcasts that summarise that book, which have been really useful in educating both my parents and those around me, that these substances, while stigmatised, unjustly so.
Any side effects, Tim, just before you go, have there been any drawbacks?
No drawbacks, but I would definitely, I'd attribute that to research, as I'm sure you guys will be discussing. Set and setting is so important for the consumption of these substances, and really putting yourself in a mind state to handle them has been important. But the only side effects from a mental health standpoint have been like immensely positive. The effect of psilocybin lasts for months afterwards.
That's interesting.
And have only been positive for me.
Tim, good on you. Thank you so much. I love that both you and your dad, Peter, were listening simultaneously and have somehow caught up and connected on air. So thank you so much. Jerome Saris is with you. He's a researcher and academic. He's the co-founder of the Psyche Institute, which launched on Friday. It's a not-for-profit and it's looking at clinical trials of psychedelic drugs. Jono, we did invite the AMA to be on today's program and they were unavailable. However, they've issued us with a statement. They've said that they support research into this area and will be interested to see the evidence-based outcomes. Last year, they lodged a submission to the TGA regarding a proposal to downschedule MDMA and psilocybin. In this submission, the ABA recognised that the treatment of medical conditions with psilocybin and MDMA is an emerging field and that research has reported positive outcomes with minimal risk to the patient. However, more highly quality research using larger scale studies and needed before it can be used more widely by medical practitioners. They go on to say finally that there are still some concerns around its use, including the potential to develop psychosis, which is yet to be investigated. Is that something that is of a big concern to you, Jerome?
In terms of the data, it should be said that this has not emerged in previous clinical trials. In fact, there's actually one study looking at, I think it's psilocybin for bipolar disorder, but for depression. So we're certainly not saying that people should be using it at all if they have a psychotic disorder. And we are certainly saying, yes, there needs to be more research.
We're talking about what role psychedelic drugs should play in treating mental illness. What do you think that is?
On ABC Radio, this is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt and Jonathan Kendall.
Today we're talking about whether or not we think about the hippies 60s and 70s when we talk about psychedelic drugs, you know, ecstasy, although that's probably a more recent drug, but when we talk about magic mushrooms and LSD, and whether or not they can play a role in helping people with mental illness or with PTSD. A new institute has been opened. Jerome Saris is still with you. He's the co-director of that. And we'll actually speak to Steve Allen in just a moment, who is a psychiatrist who's been looking into whether or not this is a good form of practice for years. But before we do, Jono, let's have a chat to Kavani Moyenahar. Now, Kavani, you've actually, I think you're going to start to work with Jerome relatively soon. What is it that you're hoping that Jerome can help you treat?
Well, I guess thank you very much for having me on to start with. I have had my own lived experience, long lived experience of mental health imbalance, I prefer to call it that, have come through my own journey and now feel like as though I'm normal, which is a strange thing to say when you've been given a diagnosis, a mental health diagnosis of depression and then bipolar, which we have discussed is something, as you guys have been discussing, it's not usually favourable for psychedelic treatment. But I'm really hoping that it will be a normal type of treatment in Australia, as it is not as yet.
And you actually went to Peru to try ayahuasca. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I had reached my end point having been in the psychiatric system here and felt it had failed me as I tried every avenue sort of basically available to me. And having done my research, I decided that, you know, It was worth trying, and I'm absolutely grateful for the experience that I have had.
Jerome, when we look at people like Kavani, that I guess, and we heard from, you know, a young man just earlier, that Tim, who are finding their own ways of doing this, how can the role of what you'll be doing at the Institute almost try and stop that and assist people to do it in a safer way?
Yes, look, absolutely, and I think that's half the issue, is that people are taking it into their own hands, and a lot of the time, as Kavani just said, getting very positive experiences from it. But it beggars the question about the standardisation of the approach, and in particular, if you're looking at giving essentially a medicine, what a person could be taking one dose to the next. You know, who knows? So I think we do need to bring some standardisation and rigour in terms of not only the medicines provided, but also the framework in which it's given to the person.
And Kavani, do you know of other people who have decided to kind of just self-medicate?
It's not uncommon to come across somebody when I share my own story for them to know somebody or have their own curiosities or have had their own experiences.
What are you hoping the Institute will help you with? What do you hope that the future will look like for you?
Well, I feel like the future is looking bright currently. I'm very pleased with Jerome and the Psyche Foundation opening their doors to really being able to create a new avenue of treatment, particularly having had my own really dark history with mental health, and that there's going to be greater hope for other people where traditional treatments have not been successful.
Mm. Well, I it's so nice to hear you say you feel like the future is bright. Thank you so much for that, Kavani. Kavani Moynihan, who has had her own struggles and is feeling better now after, well, she says, after years of going through institutions. And Jerome Saris, thank you for speaking with us this morning. We'll have to check in with you down the track and find out what the results and how the Psyche Institute is going.
Absolutely. And I'll just say also, you know, on behalf of my co-director, Associate Professor Daniel Perkins, that, yeah, we're just very happy to be on this program and just, I guess, just to educate people, open their minds that there are some other potential opportunities out there for mental health.
And just finally, Jerome, a few texts are saying, you know, if we think that this is something that would benefit us, and people are actually asking how they can participate in trials, can they just contact you? Can they contact the Psyche Institute?
Yes. I mean, I just ask them to be patient, apologetically so. It does take a while for various studies to be up and running. There are some which are starting and which are also ongoing. They can contact us at info@psyche.org, and we'll do our best to get back to you as soon as we can.
Thank you very much, Jerome. Jerome Sarris, a researcher and academic who did a doctorate at the University of Queensland at the Department of Psychiatry, and is co-director of the Psyche Institute. Godwin has been waiting for quite a while from Bacchus Marsh. Good morning, Godwin. What did you want to say?
Good morning. How are you going?
Good.
That's okay. Trying to get referrals to places like that tends to be quite difficult.
Is it something that you're interested in?
It is.
And so what do you do? Do you speak to your GP, or what's your process been?
Well, that's exactly what it has been, yep.
And what did they say?
What have you been told?
Just to try and discuss it, and if you don't have all the information, it's hard to find somebody who will go out of their way to assist you or help you.
And why do you think that trying something like a psychedelic treatment would help you, Godwin?
Exactly like they're saying. Look, I mean, I had an accident '96. I haven't worked since then. I've tried multiple things. TAC, I should say. None of them really work. So you're sort of left in limbo. Like I'm saying, unless you have all the information and the correct information, it's hard to move forward.
Yeah, and I guess it's hard to get as well, Jono, too, because if your GP doesn't know a lot about it, and we know that we can't always trust the internet. Mm. Professor Steve Allen is the Director of Psychosocial Oncology at Peter McCullum Centre. He's a professor of psychiatry as well at Melbourne Uni. Steve, you've been listening to this, but on top of that, this is something that you've been researching and interested in for years. Where do you sit?
First off, not so much researching, but interested in it for a good decade. The conversation you've been having so far has been beautiful, and it's raised all of the really important points, I think. And the issue that I said, and I'll end with what my worry is this. You know, we've got a whole lot of desperate people with conditions that don't have great treatments, including mental health illnesses, the cluster headaches, all the things that you've mentioned. And then we've got this amazing research that offers all this promise. And then a whole lot of people who say they've tried these medications and have been super successful. But herein lies the problem. It's all incredibly early research. So if you listen to all of the good things and the desperate people and the testimonials of how great it's been, you walk away with the impression that these are miracle drugs and you've got to give it a go. And that, you know, even if the doctors can't help you, so you go and you DIY, do it yourself. But the catch is that this sort of thing happens throughout the history of medicine, where these amazing treatments appear to come onto the environment, onto the landscape, and we embrace them with enthusiasm because we're so super excited, yet they often turn out not to be as good as we thought, and then we discover all the problems, and then it turns out that sometimes there's hidden problems that we didn't know. And so I guess the challenge for us as clinicians and patients, you know, as a community, is to be excited, but to then proceed with caution, because and if you'll bear with me one more second, you know, we had exactly the same problem with marijuana. So, you know, we've introduced marijuana as a treatment and doctors can prescribe it. It's got some clear indications that are evolving. But there's still a whole lot of people out there who actually think marijuana does way more than it really does. And so they're using it in ways that are risky and dangerous. And that's my big worry with this. And that's why the AMA and the colleges and stuff are all very anxious, because they're scared that by having all of these conversations where we highlight all the great things, that will give people the incorrect impression that these are fantastic treatments ready to go. It's just that us regulators haven't released them yet.
Yeah. So is this, can we blame the war on drugs for this, that, you know, there's this idea of the bad drugs and the good drugs, or the baddies and the goodies, when really we should just think of them all as drugs?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty fair account. What happened was a lot of these drugs were being researched when the war on drugs began. And in particular, the psychedelics, there was lots of good research coming out of, you know, the sort of 60s movement about how to use them and where they're appropriate and where they're inappropriate. But then the war on drugs came and we had to cut everything out across the world. And so a lot of the research stopped. Now, there's been pockets that were ongoing, right? For example, the psychedelics kept going a bit in some of the European countries and evidence continued emerging. But it didn't really hit mainstream because it was just little studies here and there and not enough subjects and all that sort of stuff. So essentially the war on drugs threw the baby out with the bathwater. So we lost the ability to get the good benefits from these drugs in our efforts to remove the bad aspects.
When listeners say, when people maybe themselves are thinking, yeah, but I've done my research on this, as the text says here, well, when your guests say, I did my research, I assume that they're suggesting that they've gone online and read studies. Now, we all know how hard it is to decipher what is real online, what is just big business when we're trying to be sold something that looks like it's good for us, but in actual fact is about just people trying to make money or sell you snake oil or whatever it may be. How easy is it for the average person to do research?
It's so hard. I've been doing research for 30 years. I've got a doctorate from a psychiatrist. I don't want to pump myself up, but I've been reading about this for 10 years. I can't make a decision. So I don't know how someone who, you know, I think it's just incredibly hard. And also there's lots of suspicion out there. So a lot of people believe that, oh, the reason we're not releasing them is because there's not enough money. The drug companies want to corner the market with their medications that make billions and they don't want competition. And so there's lots of reason, you know, sensible paranoia and distrust of authorities, which, you know, I guess, you know, a lot of these big organisations, and including governments and drug companies and stuff, don't have a great reputation. So I get why people are suspicious. So I think it's really hard to research. I certainly find it tough. But I guess what I'm trying to say is, you know, temper your enthusiasm. It's very easy to find all the positive studies on something that's exciting and something that sounds interesting. And what sounds more interesting than psychedelics and magic mushrooms? Nothing. So it's so easy to get overexcited, but you've got to temper it. And my experience is right now, people aren't tempering it. There's a lot of people using these treatments in ways that I'd consider risky.
And that was the advice from the College of Psychiatrists. We played a grab earlier from the former president of that college, just urging caution, just saying we need to do a bit more science on this. And that's why the federal government has invested $15 million into looking at these drugs. Chris is in Apollo Bay and has a question for you, Professor Steve Allen. Morning, Chris. What's your question?
Hi, Steve. Yes, I have a son with treatment-resistant OCD. He's had a terrible mental health history, and I'm just wondering if there's been any research into using psychedelics with OCD.
Do you want me to go straight into my answer, Jono and Rochelle?
Yeah. Can you respond?
In essence, I'm not aware of any in OCD. I haven't looked it up specifically. The really big areas are substance dependence, so using psychedelics to help people with alcohol and other problems, depression, anxiety, especially anxiety around the end of life that you mentioned earlier, existential anxiety about dying, and this huge area is trauma. So people who've got post-traumatic stress disorder, where psychedelics are used with psychotherapy in combination. But I'm not familiar. I've got to say, I'd have to do some work to find out if there's any in OCD. There's lots of really promising treatments in OCD, and what I'd normally say is find an OCD specialist, because it's a subspecialty that requires lots of expertise, and there's half a dozen people in Melbourne who are great, or in Victoria who are great, and I'd track them down before I try stuff that's experimental.
Exactly. And does the danger here come with people who are self-medicating, who decide to go it alone and just try things out? Is that where the danger lies?
Yeah, so I know. I've heard plenty of patients in the last year, and friends and family even, who are looking at these and experimenting and trying microdosing, and they're doing it totally blind. And they all swear to me, "Oh no, it's safe. I've looked it up and all that sort of stuff." But I've seen so many examples over my years of, you know, sedative drugs, ECT, deep sleep therapy. We even had our own scandal with psychedelics in Kew at the New Haven Hospital back in whenever that was, 1970, I think it was. And we had a mini Royal Commission back then. So, you know, I'm aware of all the problems that develop when people are enthusiastic. And I also see people pushing away traditional treatments. That's what I'm really anxious about at the moment with marijuana. I have probably one patient a month who tells me, I don't know if I need my cancer treatment because I've read that marijuana can cure cancer. And, you know, I almost fall off my chair because marijuana, yeah, great for nausea, pain. We prescribe it now in the cancer industry, but there's virtually no evidence that it cures cancer. And so my worry is people avoid decent, good, trialed, established treatments in their effort and keenness to relieve their suffering. And that's the risk that really worries me the most.
It is. I know. I can remember when my mum was going through chemo and someone asked her if she tried corn kernels. And they're probably lucky she didn't punch them. When we talk about whether or not Australia is behind here, and we know that globally Wall Street's on board, there's startups happening in the States, universities are desperate to get into what's been called the psychedelic renaissance. Yet a text here has just said, this conversation is really culturally narrow to call it the oldest psychiatric substances new. Shamans have used psychedelics for as long as history. Is this something that, you know, it's actually one of the oldest ways to look at treating something, or is that, I mean, we also, you know, have changed the way that women give birth now because we've seen that medically we can do it differently and safer for women, even though women have been giving birth since the beginning of time.
Yeah, no, it's very true. This, psychedelics have been in the literature for, I think, centuries. There's accounts of people describing them. And don't get me wrong, you know, I'm super excited too. I'm only recommending caution. I love that the government's invested $15 million. I love that we've got big groups like Mind Medicine Australia and the New Psyche Institute. And I agree it's been around forever. But let's not forget, you know, Oscar Wilde said, what was his old saying? It was, religions die when they are proven to be true. Science is the record of dead religions. So we look to our past, we apply our modern tools, science, and then those things from the past that are beneficial, we embrace. But of course, there's a million treatments from the past that were dangerous and did nothing, you know, leeches, et cetera, et cetera. I could go on for an hour.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Anna is in South Gippsland. Good morning, Anna. What's your point?
Oh, hi. Look, I have had depression, PTSD for 25 years. And to hear that all these studies are starting to come up, I think it's fantastic because I know there's a lot of people in the same shoes as me who are absolutely desperate to seek sort of something that actually works because with depression and PTSD, for me, it's just been, you know, just waves all throughout the years and you'll get to a point where you just want it to stop, you want it to go away, you don't want to go through these episodes anymore. It's just so debilitating physically. So I've had gone through all the years, I've gone through a lot of counselling, seen psychologists, doctors, and it's taken me, you know, 25 years essentially to really find the right, basically, you know, group of physicians to really help me get through it. And to hear that, you know, they're doing research on this sort of stuff, I really, you know,
that's
I really
exciting
hope
for you, yeah. Do you find researching is really hard, Anna, to decipher what is real and what isn't and what would work for you and where that body of research is really coming from?
Yeah, yeah, I think it's, you know, there's lots of rubbish on the internet. You know, there's lots of people sort of more expressing their opinions about how the drugs work without the actual science, knowing the science behind it. One of the things I sort of tried just recently was, well, you know, I've gone off alcohol completely. It's been about 3 years now. But we've tried marijuana and it's just been fantastic. And I don't encourage people to go out there and try it, but in terms of sort of stabilising the ups and downs of my moods, it's been fantastic. And I don't support, you know, having to go smoke it and do all that kind of stuff, but it's just quite an expensive treatment. And the more mainstream it becomes, I hope it will, you know, will certainly help a lot more people like me because, you know, I'm desperate. I don't want to go through those really terrible bouts of depression where you're just absolutely, you know, debilitated and you see it affect your friends, your family around you and how much it hurts them. And, yeah, I support any kind of research into psychedelics because it seems to be we're sort of just, there hasn't really been that much more in terms of how we go about treating depression and PTSD. It's sort of the same sort of antidepressants and, you know, the mood
stabilizers. That's it, it's the same, yeah. And thank you so much for your call and for just, you know, how clearly you explained that. We really appreciate it. Take care of yourself.
Thank you.
Good on you, Anna. Thank you. Just finally, Steve, I mean, where do you see this now? The federal government's given $15 million. We've seen a new institute opened in Melbourne just last Friday. Is this just the beginnings of psychedelics being used as a form? Will these clinical trials get us to that next stage of understanding how and if it works?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, Anna's call is fantastic because it illustrated where we're up to with marijuana as distinct from the psychedelics. So with, you know, the cannabis and marijuana products, we're about 20 years ahead, maybe 10 to 20 years ahead of where we are with psychedelics at the moment. They've been through research all over the world. We know, you know, where things are up to pretty well now. We can, doctors can prescribe them. You can go and see a doctor now. That couldn't happen 10 years ago, and it was the same debates around marijuana products, whereas now they're legit treatments, still in there, lots of work to go. Now, psychedelics are sort of a step back from that, but they offer incredible promise. You know, as I say, you know, I don't want to pour cold water on any of these institutes because I love that this is the way society should progress. We get ideas from the past and history, we take them, we apply our modern techniques, and then hopefully the stuff comes out. So, you know, big fingers crossed for me.
All right. Good on you, Professor Steve. Thank you. Professor Steve Ellen, Director of Psychosocial Oncology at the Peter Mac Centre and also a Professor of Psychiatry at Melbourne University, talking about all the reading he has been doing into psychedelics. He's also a regular co-host on ABC Evenings with David Astle. And this is as good a time as any just to point you in the right direction of some helplines, because Lifeline is available to you on 13 11 14. We've heard from lots of people who have been doing it tough, but others who have kind of found themselves in a better place. There's also Kids Helpline, 1-800-551-800. Men's Line Australia, 1-300-789-978, and the Suicide Callback Service, 1-300-659-467.
Thank you so much to everybody that rang in and contributed to today's show. I've learned a lot, Jono. It's been fascinating, and it feels like it's really just at the beginning. But if you missed any part of this and you think that somebody would benefit from listening to it, subscribe to the Conversation Hour podcast, go to the ABC Listen app, or go wherever you get your podcasts and click subscribe.
So that's the Conversation Hour for today. Thanks for listening, and have a good one.